Welcome to the Last Rush Hour podcast. I'm your host, Fred Pilot, author of the recently published ebook, Last Rush Hour, The Decentralization of Knowledge Work in the 21st Century. If you've ever wondered that someday soon you would no longer need to waste time commuting to and from the office and the rush hour would become a thing of the past, the ebook and this podcast are for you. Today, with modern information and communications technology, knowledge work, analyzing data, reading reports, writing and producing presentations, planning and strategizing, and collaborating with colleagues and clients can be done anywhere with a reliable internet connection and whenever one can think, communicate, and be creative and productive. Knowledge workers and their organizations have begun migrating out of the commute and office space. People are increasingly working somewhere all of the time in home offices or in their communities. Some organizations have gone fully virtual, operating without the major expense of dedicated office space. Each podcast will feature a conversation with a notable individual influencing and driving this major shift in how we work in the 21st century information economy. This episode's guest is Jack Nellis. Jack, I can't say how much of an honor it is to have you on the podcast. You are an original thinker on the big idea of using information and communications technology to decentralize knowledge work out of urban centers. Jack, you coined the term telecommuting way back in 1973, doing the first documented pilot telecommuting project with a major national insurance company. You recently received some notable media coverage in a December 1, 2015 item appearing on the website of the Atlantic's City Lab magazine, offering a back-to-the-future perspective on telework and its origins before the personal computer and the internet came on the scene. In 1973, you organized and led an interdisciplinary team at the University of Southern California to develop and test telecommuting in a real-world environment. And you were the lead author of a book based on that project called The Telecommunications Transportation Trade-Off, Options for Tomorrow. Then you subsequently authored the book Making Telecommuting Happen, A Guide for Telemanagers and Telecommuters, and the updated and expanded sequel, Managing Telework. Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, it's good to be here.
You sound good. And you're in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
The traffic.
I am.
You're in one of the most congested traffic areas of the nation, which leads to my question. Your idea about using information and communications technology occurred to you while you were driving to work on a California freeway in Los Angeles. Is that correct?
Well, that's what really got me going. I was sitting there, stopped, and one of the road signs that our transportation department puts over the road to inform you about said, maintain your speed. Well, my speed was zero at the time, and I thought, you know, this is pretty stupid. Why don't we do something about this? And then I thought, but why am I commuting to work in the first place? Scientist types can put man on the moon. Why can't you do something about traffic? You must realize I was what people call a rocket scientist at the time. My job was basically designing Earth resources satellites and other kinds of nifty spacecraft. And I thought, well, gee, we have all this technology, and why indeed can't we do something about traffic? And I got around to the fundamentals, saying, why do we have all this traffic? Well, it turns out that most of it, at least that we get caught in, is people driving to work. And then the next question, obviously, is what do they do when they get to work? And as it turned out, in 1973, about 40% of them were going to offices. And when they get to the offices, what do? They get on the phone to talk to somebody somewhere else. And I thought, why do they have to go through all this agony of getting to work in their cars by themselves, get on the phone, talk to somebody else when they could perfectly do that just as well at home? And the idea got on. The more I thought about it, the more I liked it. I couldn't get my company to support any research in this, so I moved to the University of Southern California and basically invented my job there. I would call myself a director of interdisciplinary research. and put a team together. We got a grant from the National Science Foundation in 1973 and started it. That's a pretty long explanation, but there we are.
Well, I had the same eureka moment when I was driving on a freeway, but 15 years later in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I was working for a company that made laptop computers. And, you know, I was going to an office to use a desktop computer, and I thought, well, this company is making laptop computers that basically makes this device portable.
Right.
So, the thought occurred to me, well, why don't I do my work from home, use this wonderful device they've made?
And it took a while to persuade them to do it, though, didn't it?
No, they ultimately never did go for it, and then they went out of business. But anyway, that's another story. But, it's 4 decades since you envisioned using telecommunications to connect what you called satellite remote work centers. I think they're now being called co-working spaces or distributed office spaces in communities where people live, and you're connecting them to their downtown offices. But in the 4 decades since, we've seen the metro area footprints grow. They've gotten massive, very, very big. They're the size of small states in some areas. Like in the San Francisco Bay Area, you have something like 9 counties there. It's just enormous. It takes you practically all day just to drive across it. So, obviously that's going to spawn a lot of long commutes and traffic congestions. So one might think, looking back over these last 40 years or so, that those conditions would create support for what you envisioned back in 1973. Why don't you think it became more commonplace?
Well, the support certainly exists in the minds of the people who are stuck on the freeways trying to get to work. Where it doesn't exist is in the ears of particularly middle managers who got to their positions usually because they were good at something else, and now they're thrust in this job of being responsible for other people, and they don't really know how to do it because the companies they work for don't really give them any experience or teaching about how to manage people. So they figure, well, the best way I can do is if everybody's in the office and I can see them and walk around, if something goes wrong, I'll probably stumble over it one way or another. Whereas if they're not here around me and I can't see them, how do I know they're working? And crazy as it sounds, that seems to be the fundamental fear that people have. Once you get them over that, we have found then everybody says, oh, wow, my life has changed. Things are so much better now. My stress levels go down, et cetera, et cetera. Productivity goes up, but it takes a lot of pushing to get them to that point.
Do you think that's because they're having a hard time conceptualizing knowledge work as being something that's not fixed to location? That knowledge work itself is changing, and then in terms of how we think of it now. Do you think that's part of it?
Well, that is. In fact, we're sort of stuck in the Industrial Revolution frame of mind where in order to have a job, you had to go someplace to do it. Well, 150 years ago, most people's job was at home. But that slow transition to where the job had to be somewhere else has got in our minds, and we're stuck with it.
Well, now we may be going back in the other direction.
Yeah, absolutely. We should have gone back there some time ago. But it takes a generation or two for the mindset to get back to where something new is acceptable. It's interesting. We accept technological change of some sorts really quickly in order to do things we're already doing, but with a make it faster using computers or calculating machines and so forth. But it's hard to get us to shift our cultural objectives where work needs to be to make this transition happen. But it's still happening. We still have something like 30 or 40 million telecommuters in the United States today, even though you may not see them all on the freeway, but think how worse freeway traffic would be were they not telecommuting.
Yeah, didn't you make a prediction that would see something like a quarter to a third of all knowledge workers working remotely outside of a centralized office setting by 2020?
Yeah, I did. And actually, I made it before 2020. Excuse me. But as it turns out, social change occurs more gradually than I thought in my eagerness to look into this thing, you know, 40 years ago. But it's still, the numbers are going up. And steadily, you know, the sea is rising in every respect, global warming and telecommuting.
Yeah, you have spent much of your work in this area building the business case for telecommuting, as have other consultants to companies that are looking at this. And the business case has been a tough sell. Do you think we've moved beyond having to sell the business case now, that we're moving into a different environment, a work-anywhere environment, with the maturation of information and communications technology that we're seeing today?
Well, you still have to sell the business case. I mean, the point is, if you want to get an employer to say, it's great to have my people working remotely, you've got to prove to that employer that it's going to have a neutral or better yet positive effect on the bottom line of the corporation.
What are you finding are the most attractive selling points on that?
Well, the primary one is productivity goes up. We've proved time and time again that the productivity of telecommuters tends to be 10 to 20% greater than that of their non-telecommuting colleagues. The second most important item is facilities expenses. Most employers don't pay for their employees to work at home. They don't pay part of the rent. They do are able to cut down on the size of their facilities. They don't have to be in such expensive quarters and so forth. Even though the main office may be in the fancy building downtown, they don't need to have all their back office work in expensive situations. Healthcare requirements go down. Telecommuters tend to not use healthcare as much as the in-office workers.
That seems to be a huge one now, because we're hearing quite a bit of concern from employers about healthcare costs, and probably even more so than their space costs. We're hearing quite a bit of concern about that and trying things like workplace wellness programs.
Yeah, that's right. And the evidence has been that telecommuters take far fewer sick days than regular employees that were in the office. So that's, you know, each of these little elements, the facilities, healthcare, productivity, the ability to retain people or attract new ones by offering this as an option, all of those add to a bottom line difference that can be fairly considerable. After the startup costs for telecommuting are simply training people how to do it properly, and maybe some additional equipment costs, but after that, it's all positive flow to the bottom line. There aren't any recurring capital costs.
It's an interesting concept that workplace wellness may actually not exist in the workplace at all, but rather outside the workplace. You're distributing work outside of the workplace, and you're allowing people to be in their own communities. Arguably, it may be easier to engage in healthy lifestyles rather than committing to an office somewhere.
Well, in my own case, now that I don't commute downtown anymore, I work out about 6 days a week, which would happen were I in my good old office job.
Right, right, and a lot of boomers.
I'm sure that's.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, we got a lot of generations now in the workplace, and certainly for the boomers, it's important to keep themselves in good health and work out and exercise. Probably. It's important for everybody, but I would think it's even more so for them since they're remaining in the workforce.
Yeah, they're getting old and rickety now. So,
well, let's talk about the environment. Now, there's been quite a bit of, we've had the Paris environmental meeting back in the fall, and you got originally interested in telecommuting from an environmental perspective. This is back in the early 1970s, and they were concerned about air quality and fossil fuel consumption, and we had Earth Day, the first Earth Day in 1970. Do you see a renewal of those types of concerns over the past few years, and do you think that will have an impact on reducing commuting and using information and communications technology to do so?
Well, I certainly hope so. Remember, in 1973, when we were, you know, first starting to do the quantitative research on this, it was in the middle of the first Middle East oil crisis. And there we found an interesting lesson was that as the price of gas went up, because oil prices were going out of sight, demand for oil kept going up. People were standing in lines to get in, you know, to get to the gas station. But when you can't get oil, when it's simply not available, all of a sudden companies start thinking, wait a minute, how do we get around this? How do we have some unique ways to getting around this? So disasters of one sort or another invariably teach companies to think about telecommuting. If you don't have to get someplace, you don't need to spend the oil. If you can't get there some most other ways, the communication systems tend to be relatively impervious to this sort of stuff. And I also spent a lot of time looking at the energy consequences. And as it turned out, a fairly substantial use of petroleum energy is in commuting. It's like a quarter of total energy use in a company. We can start cutting that back down where it become much less requiring oil use, and that in turn cuts down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, which reduces the growth of global warming. And this is not the final solution, but it's certainly a chink in making global warming increase less rapidly.
Another question I have for you, and I want to excerpt something that was in your book, The Telecommunications Transportation Trade-Off, that was quoted in the CityLab article that was posted in December. You said the existence of local offices, this is where people are working in satellite offices in their communities, with the schedule flexibility afforded by interactive computer networks, allow for much more part-time mobility. Do you think we'll see a shift away from the industrial age 40-hour week full-time job in the office to a more part-time project-based definition of employment with this maturation of information and communications technology and distribution of knowledge work?
Yeah, certainly that's happening now. As a matter of fact, many of the telecommuters, teleworkers, which is our term for the more geographically dispersed groups, have formed, you know, what I call evanescent organizations. They get groups of people to work together on a particular project. And they get, you know, there's sort of a broker that looks around to find the right sorts of people, puts them together. They work on the project, they get it finished. Project's done, they all sort of disassemble and get connected to other projects, maybe with other people. Now, that's not clearly not where everything is going now, but that's one of the ways in which you start to see a societal change in the way people work in terms of, you know, not the daily commute to the office, but the daily connection to one set of groups or other set of teams. You may be a member of multiple teams while working from your home and still be able to have, you know, nice income, nice benefits, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that the Affordable Health Care Act has done is to free up lots of potential teleworkers who didn't want to get into this because they felt, you know, if they left the company, they wouldn't have any health insurance, and then they were stuck. So they were afraid of going out on their own. So there's some interesting social
social changes that are, that occur because of these possibilities.
Let me get back to the idea of actually, I'm going to quote again from your book, The Telecommunications Transportation Trade-Off. You said we're now at a decision point as a society where we must decide whether the way of life made possible by the automobile since the turn of the century will or can continue, or if we should consider alternate or modified modes of working, communicating, and living. You wrote that in 1973. Are we still at that point now in 2016?
Well, some of us are. Certainly, but our different ways of organizing, different ways of living, different ways of using energy, you know, all these possibilities are being made available fairly inexpensively by the technology that's coming up. And it's still taking me much longer than I thought would happen for us to grasp some of these ideas and none of them. But it's still occurring. I figure, you know, the next generation coming up, which sees this technology as, you know, so they've grown up with it, it's not a big deal, they're used to interacting this way, so they're going to start making the changes. And you see the millennials, for example, don't want to buy new cars, which is not great for the car industry. But they prefer, you know, working whatever way they want and going to, you know, developing their own lives, so it's much more flexible than what we used to have in the past.
Did you have a chance to read by Bill Davido wrote a book, Bill Davido, I tried to have him on the program, we had some call quality problems, and he wrote a book in 2011 called Overconnected, and he talks about feedback loops created by the ubiquity of information and how things can accelerate in the political and economic environments, but he also made a point that how the automobile and the highways in the 1950s made it possible for people to live long distances from where they worked. And then we got basically into this pattern, which we're still in today. In fact, he argues that we're basically trapped in that, that it's become something of a just the way we function in the modern time, that he doesn't really see that turning around very easily. Do you see we're at a point now where metro areas have gotten so big and so hard, and access to jobs has gotten so geographically difficult that that's going to break down? You know, in other words, are we at a tipping point? Point with metro areas where they no longer work as functional local economies because the access to work and the cost of housing has just gotten too costly.
Well, absolutely. this is you know, I think I had a paper I was writing a lot. It must have been, you know, like 35 years ago, on the optimum size of the community, and it tended to be something around 100,000 to 200,000 people. Where everything functions well enough, you can get to your job if you're not working home fairly easily. You have cultural facilities available to you, schools, universities, art museums, etc. But as you grow into these megalopolises, it becomes so fragmented because of the transportation difficulties that starts to fall. It is a place where it is now. So onerous a job for us to get downtown. We live on the, you know, the west side of the mountains, and to get to cultural things downtown or go to restaurants here is so difficult. We say to hell with it, we just won't do it. So we're starting to see, as a result of this, because clearly it's not just us, but lots of people are running into this. You're starting to see local communities reforming amidst the cities. So you get what we In fact, what we started with in 1973 was looking at the 18 regional centers in Los Angeles. What we wanted to do is put in satellite offices in each one of those centers. Well, we're getting back to that now, to where we may want to have regional centers will spring up locally, because it's much easier to put them together now than it was 4 years ago. And so, in a sense, you know, we're stuck with cities just simply because of the size of the population, but you're also beginning to see some regional cities become more attractive to telecommuters, the teleworkers, because they can live in a smaller town and move there instead of being stuck in all the Sturm und Drang of the big city. It's, you know, slowly it started, migration is starting to happen, I think.
Well, we're just about out of time. Jack, I wanted to thank you for being a guest on today's podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure being here.